Hi, my name is Greg Dunlap, and you might know me from being the Drupal 8 Initiative Lead for Configuration Management, and this is episode 12 of the Modules Unraveled podcast.
Welcome to the Modules Unraveled podcast, where the Drupal community speaks, and now your host. He broke his arm while playing hide and seek, Brian Lewis.
Welcome to the Modules Unraveled podcast. My name is Brian Lewis, and today I have with me Greg Dunlap. Greg has worked for companies such as Palantir.net and Node1. He has contributed to projects including Drupal Core, Services, Deployment, and the Last.fm library. And recently, he was named the owner of the Configuration Management Initiative for Drupal 8, which is what we'll be talking about today. So, Greg, how are you doing?
Good.
Great. I'm really excited to talk to you about this. I was reading over your recent blog post announcing that the second commit has been posted, and it looks great.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I hadn't really done a lot of core work before this, so having such a big thing go in is a really cool experience for me.
Oh, cool. Well, why don't you go ahead and start out by telling us who you are and where you're from.
So I'm Greg Dunlap. I grew up in Chicago and spent most of my life there. And then about in around 2005 or so, I moved to Seattle, Washington, where I lived for 5 years before moving to Stockholm, Sweden, where I worked for Node1 for a year and a half and just recently returned to the U.S. And so now I'm currently living in Portland. Where I'm from is becoming a complicated question.
What are you doing in Portland now?
I'm actually trying to get a new company off the ground. I've had an idea for a product I want to build for the last 2 or 3 years bouncing around in the back of my mind, and I decided to take some time off and do some prototyping and work on it and see where it goes.
Oh, cool. How did you get started with Drupal then?
When I was in Seattle, I got a job at the Seattle Times, which is the biggest newspaper, daily newspaper in Seattle. And I was working on a site called northwestsource.com, which was sort of their entertainment and nightlife and shopping site for the Seattle Times. And it was like so many other products that have been built up since, you know, very early in the internet era. It was sort of an amalgam of hacked together content management systems. And like every time they needed to add a new section to the site, they would create a new CMS basically for that section. And there was no way to, like, you know, all the stuff that modern CMSs do, you couldn't do. You couldn't, you know, tie content together between the different places, and it was impossible to share assets and all of this kind of stuff. And so we were looking into moving to a new CMS, and our biggest requirement was that we had to be able to own the source code for the CMS. And we didn't necessarily mind if we had to pay a license fee to get the source code, but we had to be able to own the source code. And so we evaluated a number of options, including building our own with a framework like Cake or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we eventually decided on Drupal, mainly because, you know, for a company with an engineering team, having something that's kind of, you know, architecturally a lot easier to work with than Joomla or some of the other options made a lot of sense for us. And so we started building that site in Drupal 5, and that was my first introduction to the Drupal world. As we started building it, we brought Lullabot in for training, and that was when I met Jeff Eaton and Matt Westgate. And Jeff started talking to me a lot about contributing to Drupal, and he was really the one who first pushed me towards getting more involved in Drupal and the Drupal community. And then as things were falling apart at the Seattle Times, I was trying to think of what I wanted to do next and started sending my resume out to Drupal companies, and Ken Rickard encouraged me to apply at Palantir. And that was pretty amazing. I couldn't believe I got hired at Palantir, to be honest, because, you know, their collection of Drupal rock stars is really amazing. And from then on out, it's just been Drupal all day, every day.
Awesome. So what have you been working on recently?
I just left Node1, which is a really, really great Drupal company. They're the largest I think they're the largest pure Drupal consultancy in the entire world at this point. They're like 50, 55 people. I think phase two is pretty close to being that big. There I was doing a lot of sort of early architecture work with big clients, a lot of, you know, gathering requirements, training developers, working through problems and figuring out how to implement them in Drupal. They also gave me 50% of my billable time to work on the configuration management initiative, which was really amazing.
Yeah.
And really was a huge part of me being able to get done what I've gotten done. In addition to that, they were also super flexible about me being able to travel to go to camps and stuff. I traveled back and forth from the U.S. to Europe 5 times last year for Drupal events. And their feeling was that as long as I was getting my work done, they didn't really care where I was. And so that was super helpful for me to be able to move stuff forward. So I really owe them a lot in terms of being able to get this done.
Yeah, you're making me jealous.
But ultimately, I had been doing services work for a long time, and I was starting to get really burnt out on it. And juggling two things is really hard in a lot of ways. I mean, it was nice that I had this dedicated block of time to work on the initiative. But on the other hand, you know, trying to work on the initiative 20 hours a week and then split the remaining 20 between two or sometimes even three projects is really difficult too. And so I decided I wanted to kind of go out and do my own thing for a while. And so that's sort of what I'm doing now.
Cool. Let's jump into the Configuration Management Initiative. Can you tell us what that is and what its aims are for those who haven't heard of it?
Right. So, Drupal has some problems right now with deploying sites, and anybody who's deployed Drupal sites has run into this. And the biggest problem is that it merges and melds sort of the concepts of configuration and content in stores it all in this one great big monolithic database. In a lot of ways, that's actually really powerful and is kind of the key to a lot of the stuff that we can do. Especially when you look at things like the field system and content types and things like that, this melding of configuration and content. Because, I mean, the way that the content types are defined, the tables sort of define a lot of, the table structure defines a lot of what is your content. And it's very difficult to unravel sort of what's configuration, what's content there. And this can make it really difficult to deploy sites because If you've got a site that's running and it's live and your users are adding content to it and your staff are adding content to it and comments are coming in and all of this stuff, and in the meantime you're working on building views and menu items and all of this other stuff that you need to build to roll out new features and new sections of the site, it becomes very difficult to deploy because you can't separate those new features that you're building from the content that people are generating. And it's not like you can just take a big database dump and push it live because you're going to overwrite all of the content that has been entered since the last time that you pushed that you took a dump from the live site. And of course, when you take a dump from the live site, you're overwriting all of the features that you've been building on your own site. And so this is an area of Drupal that I've been really involved in for a long time. I built my first module, my first big Drupal contribution, the deploy module, was centered around the ability to move content between different Drupal sites. And of course, everybody's now using the features module, which is sort of more focused on the configuration side of things. But the real problem as I started exploring this more is that there are fundamental deficiencies in Drupal core itself, which make it difficult for any of these solutions to really provide an answer to the problem. Like one of the big problems that features has is that right now there's no single API for managing configuration stuff in Drupal. So it's not like there's a single place that features can go to hook in to capture all of this information. What has to happen is that either it has to work with stuff that we know exists, like the variables table and things like this, or the modules themselves have to implement stuff in a way that features knows about. So it's not like features can go out and say, here's the answer, it's all done. what features can do is say, here's an answer if all of everything else in the Drupal world implements our answer. And that's a big problem, obviously. And I mean, you know, to this day, there's a lot of stuff that features doesn't cover because it's not because, you know, it hasn't been implemented anywhere. And I mean, you know, Drupal, if you look at it, has like, you know, even in core has like a dozen ways of storing configuration information. And so that problem is really difficult. And so, and on the content side, there have been a lot of problems in terms of how we identify nodes in terms of auto incrementing IDs, because it can mean that between sites, their IDs are different. And there have been other problems in that our APIs in terms of how we save content have been either incomplete or they're too tied to the form system, which makes it difficult to do things programmatically. And so I, at some point, had decided that I was focusing on my module, I was going to more focus on fixing the problems in core that were preventing us from having any of this stuff work. And so at DrupalCon Chicago, I did a big kind of rabble-rousing core conversation. And after that, I had breakfast with Dries, and he asked me if I wanted to lead this initiative. And I told him I would if I could get my work to buy into it, because I knew it was going to take a lot of time. And thankfully they were more than happy to do it. And so that all worked out really great. And so what we're building now is sort of got two angles to it. For the configuration side, and for the purposes of this initiative, I've defined configuration as basically anything that's not an entity. And so for the configuration side, we've created a single API which interacts between modules saving configuration, and it saves them all out to files, which right now are XML files that live in a specific directory. And so when you're working in the admin, for instance, and you save some settings, it actually saves them directly out to these XML files. And then when you need to push all of your stuff live, you can just take basically the contents of this directory and pull them onto your new site. Either you can FTP them up or you can pull them out of your version control system, which is obviously what we would recommend. And you reload them. There will be a special admin area where you basically say reload configuration, and you reload it, and it spins for a while, and all of the modules do what they need to do to answer this configuration and to adjust things based on the changes to the configuration. And then all of your new configuration is live, and it's like magic. So that's sort of the concept behind it. David Strauss, at the same DrupalCon where I gave my core conversation, gave a core conversation about basically this idea. And so we at a code sprint in Denver for Drupal Camp Denver last year, me and him and Larry Garfield and Chex and Angie Byron sat down and architected the first version of this system, which is reasonably similar to what actually just got committed. So what got committed this week is the base API for this system, as well as implementations of a settings form, the system performance settings form, and image styles in the new configuration system. And that paves the way now for other systems to start implementing this this configuration management stuff and to start porting all of the other Drupal core subsystems to use it.
Cool.
And then sort of the other side of that is the content staging side, which we haven't been as focused on yet, in part because we've been sort of waiting for, there's a lot of changes going on in the entities subsystems recently, and I've been sort of waiting to see how that all plays out, because that anything that we implement on the content staging side is going to be very tied to the entity stuff. But the idea, at least my idea, is that I don't necessarily think we need a content staging solution in core. I'm much more worried about making sure that the problems in core that we've had in the past for implementing content staging are fixed. And then if we just leave it to contrib to implement actual content staging solutions, I think that's fine. Unlike the configuration side, the needs of businesses that I've talked to who want content staging solutions actually tend to be wildly diverse. And I'm not sure there is a really good generic solution for that in core. And I mean, aside from anything else, we're running out of time too. So I'm really a lot more interested in enabling that than I am in actually providing a system for it in core at this point. I mean, you know, if it ends up that we have time and we can build something that makes sense, I think that would be fantastic. But throughout the whole initiative, I've been really focused on making sure that our goals are very manageable and that I'm not trying to do too much, because I don't want to end up in a situation where I'm completely burned out and people are disappointed at what they've gotten and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
So. Do you know when the feature freeze is? You mentioned time was running out.
Dries has said that that feature freeze will be in December and that code freeze will be in January or February. With a target of release at DrupalCon Europe 2013.
Okay. I have not heard anything that specific yet, so that's really cool.
Yeah, he actually did a blog post on that about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah. So that's basically the general scope of the initiative right now.
Great.
We got this core patch in, which is really cool, but there's still a ton of follow-up work that needs to be done on a lot of really big issues. Like we talked about this reloading process. That's actually turning out to be a lot more complicated than we had initially planned. And we actually had a big discussion at Badcamp last year with me and Y-Chad and Sun and some other people about how this is going to work and how it needs to be built. And it's actually really complicated because not only do modules have to be notified about the fact that configuration is being reloaded, they need to detect what the configuration changes were that affect them. The fact is that sometimes other modules' configuration may be something that they want to be able to act on, so they need to really be able to access the entirety of both the old and new configurations. And the changes have to actually happen in a specified order, because, for instance, if you push something live that adds a new field type and a new content type and a new instance of your new field type onto that content type, mm-hmm. you can't try and create the instance of the field type before the content type and the new field type have been created.
Right.
So figuring that kind of stuff out is really, really complex. And, you know, we have some ideas for how we hope it's going to work, but, you know, we're still in the process of writing that code, and you know, it's still largely theoretical. And like right now, you can implement configuration for your modules, but that whole reload process actually doesn't exist. So the full cycle of our use case actually still can't be tested with the current patch that's been loaded into core. One of the other bigger issues that we have right now is figuring out how we're going to internationalize the configuration. And that's actually a much more complicated problem than I had realized. I mean, and it's interesting because Gabor has been sort of preaching that problem for years, but a lot of us who don't do internationalized sites never really pay attention to it.
Right.
But there's all sorts of weird things that go on there that are way beyond just translating strings. He likes to bring up the concept of the system contact form. Because, for instance, depending on the language of the site that you're viewing, you may want the contact form to go to a different person. So that's an example of a piece of configuration that can be internationalized, but it's not a translation. And right. So there's sort of a difference there between a translation and an internationalization. Another example is that if you're a site administrator and you want to send out a broadcast message to all of your site's users, you would probably want that broadcast message to acknowledge the user's main language preference, which they can set in their user settings. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of a time when you want to internationalize something, but it doesn't actually have anything to do with what the site's current language is. It has more to do with contextual stuff around what the user's default language is rather than the default language that the site is currently being viewed in. Mm-hmm. So not only do you need to be able to respond to The site's default language, you need to be able to respond to arbitrary language changes pretty much at any time. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is there are some things that you actually don't want to be internationalized. I mean, for instance, I'm trying to think of things, but like, you know, if you've got, why would you internationalize? Well, I mean, the problem is that when you internationalize something, it's different for all of your sites. But there's a lot of stuff that you don't want different for all of your sites. And to actually have it be different for all of your sites increases complexity and sort of opens yourself up to unintentional errors in some ways. And so, we've got this problem where things need to be able to be internationalized. They need to be able to be arbitrarily internationalized. But not everything needs to be internationalized. And we need to be able to represent all of these things in our file-based structure. And so that's another situation where we have sort of a theoretical solution in place, but we haven't started building it yet. And I've just been waiting to get to Denver so I can have some real face time with Gower to work this stuff out, because I know it'll just be a lot more productive. So while the first patch is in place, and that's great, and I'm hoping now that what happens with that patch in place is that a lot of this work can be a little more crowdsourced. It won't be so much focused, because it's very hard to crowdsource sort of API development. Yeah. But once that API is in place, implementing the API is something that can be crowdsourced really well. So I'm hoping that that the community will start working through these implementations while I continue to focus on these larger, bigger issues. To that end, at DrupalCon, I'll actually be running daily sessions on basically introduction to the configuration management API, where people can come and I'll walk through the API and what it means for people implementing modules and how it works and stuff like that. And hopefully by doing that, I'll have a lot of people who are familiar with it by the time our code sprint day comes on Friday. And then we can, you know, crank away and get a lot of work done, which would be really cool.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And so that's sort of where we're heading now. Now that this first patch has landed, we're moving more towards these critical follow-up issues that we need to get done. We talked a lot about whether or not they should get done for the first patch or not, but I think we all agreed that unblocking people that are waiting for the API to get in and stuff like that was more important, as long as we made sure that these critical issues got followed up afterwards.
Okay. And so people who want to get involved with this, should they go to the sandbox, or where should they be looking to help out?
So what's happening is that I've been doing all of my work for the initiative in a sandbox. And I think the URL is going to be provided as a part one in the node for this podcast. And,
yeah.
What we've been doing is we've been working from a branch, and everybody who wants to contribute to the branch, I've just been giving anyone commit access to my sandbox, basically. And then they work in their branches and I merge in their changes. And then when that main branch was done, Dries merged that branch into core, which was really cool actually, because that meant that like 20 people now had core commit, records. Like, I'm now a core committer, and XJM is now a core committer, and Sun is a core committer, and stuff like this. So I actually really like that. So I want to keep working in branches that can get merged in, because I think it's a really great way to credit people who have helped. And it's a lot more visible than commit messages. And so what I'm probably going to be doing is opening a branch in the sandbox for every new issue that we open, and we'll work from there, and then periodically roll patches from that branch and add them to the issues for people to review. There's been a lot of sort of discussion and kind of conflict about the whole concept of working out of sandboxes versus working in patches in the queue. Mm-hmm. Some people really like the sandboxes. Some people think that they're too out of the way and invisible, that they're kind of siloed away from the issue queue, which is where the real work gets done. So we're still sort of trying to figure those workflows out. But ultimately, the issues for this will be either tagged configuration system or attached to the configuration system component of Drupal core. And so people who are interested in getting involved, that's where the issues will live. And people who want to work on those issues can can come to me and I'll give them commit access to the sandbox and they can work there. Or if they just want to work from patches, they can do that too. That's fine as well. I don't want to throw up any barriers for anyone getting started. That's for sure. Okay. And also anyone who's interested can ping me on IRC, where I'm Hey Rocker. For a while I was doing biweekly, configuration management meetings in IRC, and that's kind of fallen off as I was planning my move and getting settled here. But after DrupalCon, I definitely want to get those started again, especially now that we're going to have lots more issues to concentrate on. So I usually announce those on groups.drupal.org. There's a deployment and build management group that we've been using for coordinating, and you can find that at groups.drupal.org/CMI. But there's also the core initiatives group on groups.drupal.org, which is, I don't have that URL handy, but but I'll give it to you and we can get it added to the list. And okay. a lot of all of the scheduled meetings and important topics for the core initiatives, for all of the core initiatives, have been going into that group so that people can follow them as they need to.
Great. So you mentioned that there's a lot of people helping, and you're the initiative lead for this. So what's it been like as an initiative lead?
It's been really interesting. I mean, it's been a real adjustment for me because I've never been in a big leadership, as it were, position like this before. Mm-hmm. It's been a learning experience for me, to be sure. Angie's actually really, really helped me a lot with a lot of that stuff in taking ideas and letting me bounce them off her and working with me in terms of working with the community and how she's handled problems in the past and stuff like that. A few things that I've tried to focus on since the beginning, and I've really had to build this all up on my own because I was the first initiative lead to get named, and so I was really... I've really sort of had to throw this together as I've worked, but a couple of the big things that have come out of this is that it's really important to time box big discussions because they'll just go on forever. I mean, we had a discussion about what the file format should be for the configuration, and I let that go on way too long. I mean, one of the nice things about being an initiative lead is you're supposed to be able to have decision-making process, and that doesn't mean that you can sort of be the dictator and tell everybody what to do without any community input, but it does mean that if you have a discussion that's going on and it's obviously controversial and reaching consensus is going to be difficult, then you should be able to make a call and have it stick. As long as you have reasonable explanations and can go and, justify yourself about it. And I actually spent way too much time on that, trying to build consensus where it was pretty obvious early on that there wasn't going to be any. So I've been trying to avoid situations like that going forward. I spent a lot of time early on not wanting to code a lot because I really wanted to sort of bring the community into it and get things coding. But there also came a time where that just wasn't happening. And outside of code sprints, a lot of talking was getting done, but a lot of work was getting done. And at some point, I finally just had to say, look, it's much more important that this get done, and just sat down and cranked out all of the code that I needed to finish. Like stuff like, changes to the installer to make sure that your config directory gets created at the right time and it's protected, and, the implementations and stuff like that. So sort of knowing when to crowdsource things and when not to and stuff like that has been an interesting thing. Dealing with the various personality types in Drupal is always fascinating. In different ways. So it's actually been really, really great. And it's taught me a lot about how communities like this work. And I'm actually doing a session at DrupalCon this year called Painting the Bike Shed, Lessons from a Drupal 8 Initiative Owner, where I'll sort of talk about sort of stuff like this and hopefully provide some information that other people who are looking to lead community initiatives can use to get their stuff started.
Will that be then for people who are wanting to do specifically Drupal community initiatives or like out in their regular workplace?
Yeah, I think it's some of both. I mean, I think a lot of the lessons that I've learned have been very, have wide-ranging applicability. Mm-hmm. I mean, and in a lot of ways, a lot of these lessons aren't different than any lessons that project managers or technical development managers would learn or would talk about anyways when mm-hmm. it comes right down to it, but they're not necessarily obvious for those of us who have been down in the trenches coding for half our lives. I definitely think there's some stuff that's specific to our community and the way that our community works that is a lot different than a lot of other communities. So I think it'll be solvable.
Okay. Well, when I asked on Twitter if anybody had any questions for you, Damian McKenna asked why, well, I'll just quote it. He says, why does he feel the current configuration structure is the best option?
Right. So I actually followed up with him on Twitter to clarify what he was asking about, and specifically he was mostly asking about the file formats. And so what we have for a configuration right now are XML files. They're very unstructured. They're basically XML files used as a simple key value store. So when we first started this discussion about implementing configuration in files, we knew we wanted several things. We wanted a serialized file format. We wanted something that was standard, that wasn't something that we made up ourselves. And we wanted something that was human readable. And we wanted something that could ideally be implemented in PHP space and not in user space, because it'd be a lot faster if we could do that.
Okay.
So the first thing we were looking at was JSON. As we worked through working with JSON, a couple of problems came to light. One is that you can't implement comments in JSON. And there was a group of users who thought that this was very important. Another thing is that when you use JSON in PHP, it automatically encodes all Unicode characters. So it doesn't actually print them as Unicode characters. It prints them as like 0/EE56 or something like that, which is not really ideal.
Right.
It was suggested that we could write our own sort of wrapper around JSON encode and JSON decode to get rid of that. But one of the whole points of using JSON in the first place was that it's implemented in PHP and C code, and so it's very, very fast.
Yeah.
We were sort of looking through this and thinking that maybe JSON wasn't going to work. And so that was where I opened up a discussion on groups.drupal.org about what file format to use. And that discussion spanned two threads with over 300 comments. And basically what it came down to was groups of people like certain formats for their own reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point I was getting frustrated with this because a lot of these reasons weren't really benefits of the format. And a lot of people would be like, oh, JSON's more readable than XML. But then another group of people would be, XML's more readable than JSON. And one of the things that came out of that is that readability is in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. And that all of these are human readable formats. And that one being more supposedly readable than the other is not an argument that should be taken into account. Yeah. Because it's so subjective. And so I was talking to David and Angie about this at a conference in Portland last year, and David suggested that we should think about using XML, because really the biggest problem with XML was going to be that so many people would just go, ew, XML about it. Not that there's anything functionally wrong with it, because functionally it's great. You have simple XML support in PHP core. It's a very, very widely used format. There's a huge tool chain on every platform in existence for it. And it's completely interoperable with tons of external tools because everybody supports it. And another thing that we wanted in terms of getting a standard format was to be able to interact with standard deployment tools like, you know, Chef and Puppet or your own scripts and stuff like this. I basically made an executive decision and said, unless somebody can come up with a real reason not to use XML, we're going to use XML. And a lot of people complained about, you know, oh, it's ugly and it's old school and readability and blah, blah, blah. But really, when it comes right down to it, there's no reason not to use it. Mm-hmm. And so we started implementing it. And that was sort of how that decision came down. It was just one of those things where I finally just said, this discussion is going nowhere. It's not going to go anywhere. Let's just do something, because making a decision is at this point more important than any individual decision we make. And it's not like we can't change this down the road. I mean, you implement a different serialization and deserialization function. You write a script to convert all of the stuff to a new format, and you're done. This is not rocket science mm-hmm. to change down the road if XML doesn't work. Now, it turns out that we have had some problems implementing stuff in XML, and we may reopen this decision down the road. But, I mean, we're going to have problems implementing stuff in any format is what it comes down to. And a lot of the stuff that we've done in Drupal is focused on implementing itself in normalized relational database tables. And that's not necessarily always going to be the best way to implement things in flat files. And so sometimes we're going to need to rethink how we store and represent the data. Sometimes that's not going to be ideal for any file format we have. And for any given file format we have, that's going to be true. We're going to need to be able to hold metadata about the data too. I mean, there are a lot of issues where this comes down into. So, you know, that discussion is ongoing, but as far as why I chose and thought this format was best, it was basically I needed to make a decision, and there was nothing wrong with this format specifically, and so that's what I did.
Fair enough. So where are those XML files going to be in the folder structure?
So what happens is, like, if you, let's say that you create a module and you want to have some settings, then in your module, you will create a directory called config. And in that config directory, you will supply the default configuration XML files for your module. And when your module is installed, those XML files get copied to Drupal's central configuration directory. And that directory is a directory, it's in your files folder, and it's got a randomly generated 52-letter hashed name, because we have to be able to store these files world readable, and they could contain sensitive information. And so this is our way of sort of hiding them so that the world at large can't browse to them and read information out of them. Okay. And that's where all of your active configuration will live. And when you interact with things through the admin and stuff like that, all of those files will live in there. And then when you want to push, then when you, as changes occur, you can check anything from that directory into your version control system, or you can just push all of that entire directory live to your FTP, via FTP or whatever, and reload. And that's to the live configuration directory on your live side or your production side or whatever. And do a configuration reload, and then all of that stuff will get read in and implemented.
Great. So basically, the core will have some basically core configuration in that file, and then when you install, say, the views module will have its own configuration, but it'll automatically be added to the core config file as well, so that everything takes effect there.
Yeah, I mean, they'll be added to the core config directory. It'll actually be, there will probably be hundreds of files in that directory implemented by different modules. And all of the core config is actually implemented by core's modules too. And so, for instance, right now the system module ships with system.performance.xml, which is the file that holds the performance settings for the performance screen when you set that. But there's also blocks.performance.xml, because the block module form alters in a setting for caching of blocks onto the performance module. Mm. And so it provides the default for that setting. Because we want to isolate the settings to the modules that implement them. So if you uninstall a module, we can get rid of that configuration file. And it won't be sitting around and getting accidentally implemented and stuff like this. But you'll also be able to implement stuff on behalf of other modules. For instance, if your module implements an image style, a default image style, then you'll be able to have, like right now, the files are image.style.stylename. And so, like, core ships with image.style.thumbnail, image.style.large, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so you could ship with image.style.mymodules, image style, and when it gets installed, because of the namespace, it'll get recognized as an image style and get picked up by the image module and be listed in there and stuff like that. So a lot of this is keyed not only on there being XML files, but how the XML files are named and namespace to be recognized as being implementations for a specific module and things like this.
Okay, so as an example of that, basically a photo gallery module could be created that would then have the thumbnail for that, the large and the full size or whatever, and those would all be automatically added as image styles just by installing the module.
That's right. And it could also implement, in theory, a default view, which would get copied in there and then be picked up by the views module too.
Great. Wow.
And then when that, and because all of the config that that module provides is in its config directory, when that module is uninstalled, we can go and we have the list of all of the config that it defined, and we can get rid of it too.
Cool.
Yeah.
Really quick, I just want to clarify on the configuration XML files. So basically the views module will have a config directory with files in it. And those files will get copied to the core config folder?
That's correct.
Okay, so then if you update the views, it'll update that, and will then that those updates be merged over somehow, or?
The update process will probably, there will probably need to be something that happens in update hooks to copy that over, because right now the copying happens on module installation. So okay. If, for instance, as an upgrade from views 1.1 to 1.2 or something like that, you provide some new configuration files, you would probably have to manage that yourself in an update hook, the copying of that configuration stuff over. But I mean, it's a pretty simple operation, and actually there's an API function to do it for you in the config API. So you could just call, I think it's config install default config, and you give your module's name, and it does it for you. So
cool. Okay, so I guess that takes care of overriding your custom configuration as well, since it's not in the... Sorry, go ahead.
What do you mean?
Oh, well, I was going to say, like, if it was in the views config folder and you updated views, it would overwrite that one. But with this, since it's copying it over to the core config folder, it's not overriding your custom configuration.
Right, that's correct. It's only overriding the stuff that views itself provided.
Cool. Awesome. This, can you just release Drupal 8 tomorrow so we can start using this?
Oh, God, please no.
It's really exciting stuff, though. I mean,
it is really exciting stuff. It's a little scary, too. I mean, like I said, there's a lot of stuff that we still have to work on that isn't finished, but it is really exciting, too. I think it's really important, and I'm really happy to be working on it.
Yeah. One more question from Twitter, who was Larry Garfield Krell, asked, are the UUIDs and deployment still part of your initiative, or have those fallen by the wayside?
So the first patch that we committed as part of the configuration management initiative was an API to generate UUIDs for core.
Okay.
And that was committed. And the idea was that in order to solve this problem that we have of nodes or entities at this point being uniquely identified by serialized auto-generated IDs from the database that differ between sites, we could implement UUIDs on them, and that would provide us with a constant and identifier that's the same between sites. And we wouldn't use the UUIDs for anything else, because there's a lot of advantages to using small numeric IDs for the purpose of unique identification, especially when it comes down to indexing and using them for joins and queries and stuff like that. They're really efficient. And so what we did was we were planning on laying the UUIDs alongside the existing primary keys. So you would use the existing primary keys for internal Drupal stuff, just like we do now. And the only reason you would ever need the UUIDs is to compare a piece of content or find its match between sites. So the idea was that after the entity API stuff gets a little more solidified, then we would start implementing UUIDs as part of the entities. And basically any entity that got generated would also have a UUID generated alongside of it that would become part of it. And so basically that is still on the plan for the initiative. It hasn't happened yet. I assume that when I'm in Denver, I'll have a talk with Fago. Has really been Wolfgang Ziegler from Germany has really been pushing the entity improvements for Core, and so I'm sure that while I'm in Denver, I'll have a talk with him and get an overview of where that's at, because that definitely needs to happen. That is like the key part of the of implementing the content staging stuff for Drupal 8. So there's definitely a plan for it to happen. But on the other hand, because this other stuff has been moving and we have more control over it, obviously it's been moving a lot faster and getting more places. So it's definitely still on the plan for the initiative.
Can you give an example of what that'll look like? Because I'm not quite able to wrap my brain around it. I'm not as smart as you. So.
It's not about smart. It's about, I mean, everything. I don't have a lot of training in computer science. I have no formal training at all. And so I like to say that everything that I know about computer science has been made by having horrible, crucial mistakes happen over and over at exactly the wrong time. So let's say that you have a node, like, and it's node one, right? Uh-huh. And so you want to move this node to a live site, right? So you move this node to your live site, and so nodes get consecutively numbered, mm-hmm. and that number is auto-generated by MySQL when the nodes are generated. So you generate a node, it's node one, you go to your live site, and it could be that node one on your live site has already been taken. Because forums, somebody could have created a new forum topic, and that would be a node, for instance.
Okay.
And so you can't have node one on your live site anymore. So now that maybe becomes node two on your live site. Now, the problem is that if I want to push updates of that node from one site to another, I have no way to know that they're the same node anymore because their IDs are different. Mm-hmm. And that's basically one of the fundamental problems of staging content in Drupal is that there's no guarantee that content, once it moves from one site to another, you can push the content from one site to another. But the problem is that you can't push updates because once the content is pushed, you have no guarantee that its IDs will remain the same between the two sites.
Right.
So for the deploy module, what I did was I implemented UUIDs, universally unique identifiers that I put alongside the node IDs in a separate table because I couldn't, as part of contrib, I couldn't modify. I didn't want to modify system tables, and so. Right. What I had was a mapping of node ID to UUID, and then when you pushed a node to the live site, it would also have a mapping of node ID to UUID. So node five on your production site would have a UUID of XYZZY, and then node node 10 on your live site would also have a UUID of XYZZY, and so that gave me the ability to match nodes together to be able to provide content updates, even though their node IDs were different. And so what I did, I was using the services module to do this all over the World Wide Webs or whatever. And so uh-huh. I wrote a bunch of code for services module that allowed you to say, hey, I've got node one over here and it's UUID XYZZY. Do you have a UUID XYZZY over there? And if so, what node number is it? And it would tell me, and then I could push changes between the two sites because I knew how to match them up.
Okay.
And I also put together this whole, another thing that's very complicated with the content deployment is that pieces of content depend on one another, right? So for instance, your piece of content may node reference another piece of content, which may user reference a user and several taxonomy terms and all of this kind of stuff. And those chains of dependencies can get very tricky. And so I actually wrote a bunch of code to actually manage all of that dependency chain stuff too, which was, that was easily where I spent most of my time, to be honest. And so, so that was the key for the stuff that I wrote for the deploy module. And for, so what we're talking, and so basically we're bringing that concept into core is what it comes down to.
Okay. I haven't used the deploy module. What versions of Drupal is that available for?
So I wrote mine for Drupal 6. And then when I took on the initiative, I gave away all of my modules because I wanted to be able to focus on it. And so Dick Olson, who used to work at Node 1, but now works at Al Jazeera in Qatar, and Catherine Bailey, who works at ImageX Media in Vancouver, took over the deploy module, and they've been rewriting it for Drupal 7. I'm not quite sure what state it's in yet. I think they were getting ready to release an RC for Drupal 7, but I haven't looked at it in a long time. And they've basically rewritten an enormous amount of the code that I wrote, which is great because a lot of the code that I wrote was like, it's like the first version of anything you do that's very complicated. You learn everything that you did that was wrong. And right. So now you get to go back and fix all of those problems. And so they've been working on that for Drupal 7. And Dick is giving a core conversation on content staging in Drupal 8 for Denver, which I have no idea what he's going to say. So I'm really interested in seeing that. It'll be at the same time as mine about the status of the configuration management initiative, which I think is actually the first core conversation of the conference. That's the status of deploy module right now. The version for Drupal 6 is what it is. And it's not perfect, but it works for a lot of use cases. And then the version for Drupal 7 is basically a total rewrite, and I'm not really fully up to date with where that's at right now.
Okay. I just looked it up, and it's still in dev status right now. Okay. But I might have to look into that just to get ready for Drupal 8.
Yeah. I know a lot of people have been itching for this, and I hope that everybody who's been itching for it gets involved as much as possible, because unless people are getting involved, we can't solve all of the use cases that, mm-hmm. that we need to. And one of my greatest fears is that we're going to be 2 months before code freeze and somebody is going to come up with some use case that's completely valid that we haven't thought about at all.
Right.
It's really important for people to get involved in this stuff now. We're here working on it, and we're here to listen. But the longer and longer that we go on, the harder and harder those big changes are going to be to make. So I vastly encourage people to research the system as it exists now. Make sure to understand it and that it's going to cover their use cases so that we can figure out what to do about it.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and wrap up this episode then.
Okay.
I've got a couple of questions for you that I ask everybody. And the first is, what are you most excited about that's up and coming?
Outside of CMI, of course, I'm actually super excited to see what happens with the Whiskey project. We had a sprint in Boston that was around Whiskey that I was invited to participate in. Because actually Whiskey has a lot of dependencies on CMI, and me and Larry have been working a lot together on that stuff for a long time. And so I really think this concept of sort of getting away from the not invented here aspect of Drupal and implementing standardized components that we know work is a really great trend to be working towards. I think the idea of, really tearing apart a lot of Drupal's internals and sort of upgrading them to be a little more modern. I mean, a lot of Drupal's internals were written with PHP 4 in mind, Uh-huh. A lot's happened since PHP 4. And I think it makes sense at this point for us to do some work that's a little more revolutionary than evolutionary, because, I mean, the technical debt that we hold at this point is really pretty severe. While there's no doubt that this will have effects on our community and the types of developers that we attract, I think it's super important Fabian, who's the lead developer for the Symphony project, was at this sprint, and one of the things that he pointed out is that when he tore Symphony apart, he basically did a complete rewrite of Symphony 1 to Symphony 2, and within 6 months, he had as many components as Symphony 1 had had in 4 years.
Wow.
And he's also noticed that his contributor base has grown and gotten younger and gotten more passionate. And he totally attributes that to the fact that he went to a more modern architecture that's more object-oriented, that's more componentized, that, you know, uses the kind of development principles that people are taught in, you know, modern programs and at modern jobs these days, you know. So I thought that was really interesting, because while there's no doubt that that kind of work will alienate a certain subset of developers, of which I am mostly one because I have no formal computer science training myself. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to keep moving forward, and to keep, you know, staying relevant in the modern world, you know. You know, it's a tough discussion to have, and obviously it's been going on for a long time, but I'm really, really excited about a lot of the work that's going on there and a lot of the ideas and what it's going to mean to Drupal going forward and stuff like that.
Cool. And where can people find out about you and the things that you're working on?
My Twitter is probably the best place to do that at this point. So that's HeyRocker on Twitter, HeyRocker. I, you know, important stuff that I'm doing as part of the initiative, I also post on that the groups.drupal.org/CMI group has been sort of the main focus of discussion points for the initiative. And then and I have a blog too, but I mean, I post to it like twice a year or something like that. I've actually posted to it twice in the last 2 months, which I think is a record for the last 4 years or something like that. So I wouldn't recommend necessarily using that as a place of getting news and anything that I happen to be doing at any given time.
Okay. All right. Well, Greg, I'm really glad that you came on. I had a lot of fun talking to you and learned a lot of great stuff about CMI.
Cool. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the ability to get more work out about the project.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on, and we'll talk to you later.
Cool. Thanks.
All right, if you have any more questions for Greg or for more information about CMI, head on over to modulesunraveled.com/podcast/012, and there you'll find the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to ask questions on the podcast, do what Damien and Larry did and follow me on Twitter @modsunraveled, and you'll get my tweets about who I'm going to be talking with. Or if there's someone you'd like me to talk to, let me know either on Twitter or at modulesunraveled.com/contact. And if you're listening to this episode the week it is released, we've got about 1 week until DrupalCon Denver. Woo! I might even be doing a live show from Denver. So if you'd be interested in that, let me know. And again, follow me on Twitter. And if that goes through, I will let you know there. That's all for this week. So I'll see you in Denver.